This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott.
Sunday morning, slow beats see them.
Much as Colonel Sanders once declared that his was the only way to fry chicken, some Christians on the far right believe theirs is the only way to do religion. Worse, they're attempting to link their brand to political power. Seeming to agree that God speaks exclusively to this group, Senator Bill Frist claimed that all Democrats are against people of faith. In response, a group of 430 Christian pastors and rabbis wrote a letter to the Honorable Senator, first decrying inflammatory falsehoods and affirming America's tradition of religious respect, tolerance, and pluralism. Now back to Kathy and Jim Wallace.
Jim, I worry deeply. Why are we blind to the, I'm going to be polite here and call it irony, when someone puts out there that our administration is the culture of life, and yet they reverse a ban on assault weapons, and they're for the death penalty, and they fought to allow us to execute people that had committed crimes when they were younger than 16, preemptive war, belittling the Geneva Convention, and now the EPA is going to test pesticides on children in Florida. How do they get away with calling that a culture of life?
Well, they co-opt language. That was the Pope's language, of course, before it creeped into the White House. And then it got transformed into a partisan wedge. They use these issues as wedges and weapons, where religion is supposed to be a bridge, not a wedge, a bridge that brings us together across all our cultural political divides. Issues of globalization and standing for economic justice and workers' rights and human rights, a global economy that's marginalizing the human rights of millions of people. They don't want to talk about that. And the death penalty, the bishops here, they have begun a new campaign against the death penalty. Helen Prejean was on, I saw her one night on a late-night TV show, about her new book, about the number of people, innocent people even, we are executing on death row. And so this is where I'm a kind of an honorary Catholic. I'm a friend of the family. And I love the consistent ethic of life, which really doesn't have a kind of selective morality, which I think politics does all the time, where we select one set of lives and issues over another. The right and the left both do that. And that's where I think a prophetic religious response has to be lifted up. So we don't let them do this selective politicizing of our values.
Thank you so very much, Jim Wallace, for being with us today.
Thank you so much. You guys are doing such a terrific job, and it shows me that we've got to build our own movement, and we can. And the young people, I mean, I'm sending books for 15-year-olds, 14-year-olds. The other day, a little tiny girl was standing there when I looked up from the table. I says, "How old are you?" She said, "I'm 11. I said, "You're 11 years old." I stopped the line. I said, "What did you get from tonight?" She said, "Well, I think we're just going to have to change the world." I said, "Really? And who's going to do that?" "I think probably people like me." She was 11 years old.
Yeah, out of the mouths of babes.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The budget for 2006, featuring cuts in scores of social programs that middle and low-income families rely on, comes to us from compassionate conservatives. In April, a compassionate Congress voted to slash Medicaid, the country's health program for the poor, by $10 billion over the next 5 years. The president recently touted his tax cut, saying that middle-class Americans will save an average of $742 this year, neglecting to mention that the top 1% earners will save $34,948. And millionaires? $103,086. Now that's compassion. Then again, compassion is possibly better practiced by genuine faith-based traditions. Jesuit priest, teacher, and author of Call to Discernment in Troubled Times, Dean Brackley was schooled in true concern for the least in our society during the 1980s as a staff member of South Bronx People for Change. Dean also worked on the Lower East Side of New York City at the First Nativity Middle School for inner-city kids. In 1990, Father Brackley was sent to El Salvador to replace one of the six Jesuit priests who were murdered the year prior. He still teaches there at the Universidad Centroamericana. During a recent trip back to the States, Dean visited Mary Knoll. Kathy Golden asked Dean Brackley about his years in New York and about his chats with the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, Dorothy Day. Dean Brackley.
Dorothy Day said, "Stay close to these people in your neighborhood, like these women who are sleeping in doorways and these women who are cooking at their stoves with varicose veins and these men on the Bowery, these men who had come back from Vietnam." And Dorothy Day was ultimately right. That's where you find your grounding. That's where the cross is. That's where the center is. And I discovered that when I was there, I felt less scattered. I felt more myself. I felt, sure, sometimes discouraged and sometimes anxious, but somehow centered. And that was the great lesson in my life, that we find our way with people who are broken, with people who are hurting.
That's very interesting that you say that, because I read today some of the things that you've written in the past, and you talked about visitors to Salvador, where you are now, and you talked about how those of us who are privileged enough, shall we say, to be even middle-class Americans, when confronted with poverty, might seek it out for a minute to look at it like it's a foreign object. But something in that not only helps us, but at first we fear it. We fear what we're looking at.
When we look at poverty from the outside, and as we approach it, it's depressing. But when you meet the people, that's where something happens, something special. You find out not only is the world a lot worse than I thought it was, there's something going on that's much more wonderful than I dared to imagine. And something goes on in that encounter with poor people, with victims, with outcasts in the world that heals us. In many ways, people of my own middle-class tribe, we need these people more than they need us. You know, I think our own tremendous suffering, you know, in the suburbs, the anguish, the anxiety, the loneliness that people experience, what we have to recognize is that this suffering, this inner division, is partly a product of the kind of society that we live in. It's the mirror reflection of the pain of the inner city, for example, the pain of the third world. And somehow when these two worlds come together, we become healed, I think.
In 80, the Mary Knoll sisters died and Archbishop Oscar Romero was assassinated, murdered. 9 years after that, six Jesuits down at the college there and their housekeeper and her daughter were also massacred. You leapt into that fire. How did that come about for you?
I had just begun teaching theology at Fordham University in the Bronx, and I knew something about El Salvador. I had visited, and I heard about these deaths really the morning that they occurred. It was shocking, of course. And then I began to ask myself, what's going to happen? What will they do? They don't have people there who are trained to run universities, and many people teach in them. What will the Jesuits do? They'll have to reach outside. And I began to have the sensation that I was watching a fastball come across the plate. And, of course, you can take that pitch. You can take that fastball. You can let it go by, or you can swing at it. I knew Spanish. I was prepared. I had done graduate studies in theology. I was teaching at Fordham. I knew something about Central America. I was, in a sense, qualified to at least offer myself. And I could have let that pitch go. I could have said, well, no, I'm beginning here. But then you ask yourself, how many pitches like that do we get in a lifetime? You know, and it was that idea, you know, of kind of that image of the fastball coming down the middle. I really, in the end, had no reason not to swing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I swung. And of course, I wasn't sure, and it was improbable that they would accept my offer. But in fact, they did. Yeah.
What was the atmosphere like? You went down there how soon after the death?
I waited for the end of the school year. So by that time, in July, after the killings took place in November, the university was still traumatized, but was operating with a semblance of normalcy, you know. There was a lot of chaos. I felt totally inadequate to the job, totally inadequate, you know. And people were not sitting around, you know, as though we were in therapy sessions, you know, working through this. They were just, you know, people going a mile a minute. So I had to learn a lot of stuff on the fly.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, maybe the same month that the Jesuits died, earlier, close, not long before, there was that bombing in the Capitol at lunchtime, where all the carts were, and they knew that the people would be eating their lunch, and they just, I don't know how many people died.
Yeah, that was October 31st, I think.
Something.
And the actually, that was the trigger that launched the guerrilla offensive in order to unblock the negotiations. They were convinced that with this right-wing bombing going on, that they had to somehow demonstrate that they were still a military force and launch their offensive. And it was under the cover of that offensive that the army wanted to kill the Jesuits and others and get away with it, you know, in the heat of that that combat of the offensive in the Capitol.
You've been there from that time to now, so you've seen this whole transition. What are the lessons of Romero's life and death there? What's changed and what hasn't?
The war ended in 1992, and so it's 13 years of post-war period. Romero, it remains a gigantic figure. He was not created by this conflict or by political parties in the Salvadoran conflict. He's a giant of a human being, a great figure in the church. I like to think of him as almost a father of the church for the 21st century.
Allow me to embarrass you in saying goodbye by telling you are a very eloquent man, Dean Brackley, and I look forward to reading the book.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
Believe that the separation of church and state is an American tradition worth preserving? Email us. Go to www.maryknoll.org/voices and just click on Contact Us. Or call us at 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Jim Wallace and Dean Brackley are just two of the voices of our world. This week's show is produced by Kathy Golden, and I'm your host, Eileen Bott. You heard music today by Ani DeFranco from her latest Knuckle Down CD and by Herb Morrison. To suggest a topic or for more information on today's guests, just go to our program's website, www.maryknoll.org/voices. To get Mary Knoll Magazine, in English or Spanish, please call 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. If you missed a portion of this program, you can catch us on our website, www.maryknoll.org/voices. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.